On Tech News Today, Samsung plans to launch a fifth smartwatch product on a fourth software platform, and politicians want to kill voluntary industry kill switch proposals. All that and more coming up next.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Wednesday, April 16th, 2014. This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by ShareFile. Enhance your workflow, send files of almost any size easily and securely with ShareFile by Citrix. Try ShareFile today for a 30-day free trial. Go to ShareFile.com and click the microphone and enter TNT. And by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your used Apple and Android devices are worth at gazelle.com. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Mike Elgin.
And I'm Jason Howell.
Tech News Today explores the big stories of the day in conversation with some of the world's best journalists. Our guest co-anchor today is Don Reisinger, a technology journalist who writes for CNET, eWeek, Slash Gear, and other publications. Welcome, Don.
Hey, how are you?
Very well, thank you. I've been trying to get you on the show for a long time.
Glad
to have you here at long last.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
All right, wonderful. Let's jump right into the news. Samsung.
Let's do it.
Revealed some unexpected future mobile and wearable plans yesterday. The company is unique in the wearables industry because it makes not one, but four different smartwatches. Yesterday, Reuters learned that the company will also come out with a fifth smartwatch, this time supporting Google's Android Wear platform. We also found out that Samsung plans two Tizen smartphones for some reason. With us to explain all this is Vlad Savov, a senior reporter for The Verge. Welcome, Vlad.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So why do you think Samsung would want to offer five smartwatches based on four software platforms? Isn't that a bit much?
Well, technically, I don't think it's quite five smartwatches. The Gear Fit, which uses a custom operating system, is really a smart band. It's a fitness band and tries to do something slightly different from smartwatches. Smartwatches tend to be a bit more functional and a bit more fully featured than the Gear Fit. So we can kind of set that one aside and say, that's Samsung's effort for the fitness market. But in terms of smartwatches, Samsung already tried to do an Android smartwatch. That was the original Galaxy Gear, which was announced and released late last year. It really didn't do well. It had a whole bunch of limitations, a whole bunch of failures, frankly. Samsung put a camera in the wristband itself, which made the wristband non-replaceable. So it came back this year. It came back with its own Tizen OS, its open source software, and it tried to do better. It tried to improve on things. And it did to some extent with the Gear 2 and Gear 2 Neo, but they haven't been massive improvements over the original Galaxy Gear. So really and truly, the company isn't so much offering a great variety of smartwatches as it is trying to find its way and trying to find the right smartwatch.
It's interesting that you make a strong distinction between the smartwatch and the smart band. I think a lot of people in the industry don't make that distinction. If something is lashed to your wrist and is smart in some way, connects to a smartphone or whatever, or does anything that's intelligent, has chips inside of it, they call it a smartwatch. So that's an interesting distinction, and I think it's an important one because there is a huge difference between the bracelet-style devices and the wristwatch-style devices. So I appreciate that. But before we get into
One point on that. I'm sorry. Excuse me.
Sure, jump in there.
Just one thought. Because I actually wrote a story on this for CNET last week, and the researchers are now saying, look, there are three different types of smart devices out there. There are those so-called dumb devices, like the Nike stuff and the Jawbone Up and all that stuff. And then there are the slightly more sophisticated devices like the Gear and maybe the Pebble. And then we have the Google Glass and products like that. And so what these analysts are saying is, over the next couple of years, we're going to see these so-called lower-end or less sophisticated devices drive much of the wearables market. But over time, it's going to be those more sophisticated products like Google Glass and like whatever else might be coming along that are ultimately going to drive this marketplace. So I think it's interesting that I think even the analysts, even the researchers are saying we have to draw those distinctions because they are different. They're serving a different market, and maybe they're serving a different purpose for a lot of people.
Absolutely, and I think they're not just distinctions to be drawn between different wrist-based devices, but also the whole wearables world has multiple different categories that we're going to be seeing. You know, built into clothing, things with no screens. There's lots of things coming out that we're going to have to come up with and coin new terms to describe them and basically explain what the heck they are and what the heck they do. So Vlad Savov, now you wrote about the whole, you know, announcement thing, and they're coming out with this. They keep pushing this Tizen operating system, which is a curious thing, and I tend to think that this might be kind of hedging their bets, kind of giving them a bargaining position, but just about everybody else besides Samsung is rejecting this platform. For example, NTT Docomo recently dropped Tizen. They had announced Tizen phones coming out and then said, you know what, never mind. And here, you know, here Samsung is embracing it, coming out with two new phones apparently. And also they still have it in a couple of their current existing watches. It seems to me that for smartwatches, for example, the Android Wear platform is, you know, probably the way to go. And for smartphones, clearly Android is the way to go for Samsung. Why do you think they keep pushing Tizen?
Well, I believe it's exactly what you just said. It's an alternative. And if you actually look at Tizen's promotional materials, they're not really consumer-centric. The first thing that Tizen says is, we're an open-source operating system. We're giving variety, diversity of choice to carriers. So that's their big pitch. They're talking to mobile operators, to carriers. And I guess, I don't know how strong of a bargaining chip it is, but when you go to speak with Google, it is good to be able to say, well, we have our own software that we can move to. And, you know, we have this massive audience of people, massive customer base who already own Galaxy devices, and we can pull those away from Android. Like I said,
I don't think Google cares.
I don't think Google cares because
at the end of the day, you know, Samsung needed to cross-license certain aspects of Android with Tizen. So Google's saying, look, guys, if you do what you got to do. If you want Tizen, go with Tizen all day long, but we're still going to get a piece of the action here. So I don't know how much Google really cares anyway. I mean, it's Tizen, Android, go do what you got to do, but we're going to get a piece of the action anyway. And I think that's the secret sauce here for Google. It's and Microsoft, mind you, because Microsoft, you know, when you use an Android device, you're paying Microsoft too. So you know, the secret sauce here is in the licensing. It's in the ability for all these companies to make money in ancillary ways, regardless of what they're doing. It's an interesting thing, and I think it's something that we're going to see more and more. And I think that really reduces Samsung's bargaining chip, no matter what it is with Google, because they're saying, look, you guys, if you want to go out and be the Tizen guys, fine, but we're still going to generate a little bit of revenue off that.
Absolutely. And just to add, the Tizen proposition has been going on for a long time. And the amusing thing about today's news is that you could rewind back a year and you could say exactly the same thing for Samsung's roadmap. Samsung, this time last year, was being speculated that it would introduce an Android smartwatch. And Samsung itself promised that it would have a high-end Tizen smartphone for 2013. So now the company is essentially going through one of those matrix revolutions where it just does the exact same thing. It's just the difference now is that maybe a Tizen phone will happen. It was intended to initially come out in 2013 with NTT Docomo that you guys mentioned and Orange in France, I believe. That didn't happen. It might happen this year. And the big difference to me on the Android side is that the Galaxy Gear taught Samsung a lot of hard lessons, and Android Wear is a customized version of Android and has a much bigger take-up of companies and much more promise than we had last year.
Mm-hmm. Now, Vlad Savov, do you think that that embracing Android Wear will enable Samsung to build a smartwatch that will work on all Android or work with all Android devices rather than just a small number of Samsung devices?
Well, I wouldn't see any reason why not.
I mean, the only reason would be for the same reason that all their previous smartwatches and smart bands don't work with non-Samsung devices, which is apparently that Samsung prefers it that way. They see the smartwatch as a way to boost their smartphone brand, as far as I can tell, unless there's some technical reason why it's difficult somehow for Samsung to make their devices work across platform. But I, you know, so far I haven't seen any evidence that Samsung is interested at all in smartwatches that work with non-Samsung phones.
Yeah, Mike, you know, are we missing a macro factor here, and that is a lot of these major companies that are popular, that are doing well, that are generating, you know, billions of dollars in revenue, they're literally – look at Google. I mean, you know, yesterday's acquisition of these companies are doing anything they want. They're throwing things up against the wall, hoping they stick, and just saying, look, we have the money. We have the ability to buy out smaller firms if they come up with something really cool. Samsung's doing it. Google's doing it. Apple has the cash to do it. Microsoft is doing it to some degree. Are these companies now saying, who cares how many products we offer? Who cares what we're doing? If one of them works, great. If not, we'll toss it away. We'll take the hit financially, and we'll make the billions on all the other products we sell. It seems like this is happening a lot more and more. Facebook's doing it. You know, these companies are just willing to spend cash because they have it, and they say, hey, what the hell? We're not losing anything for it other than the money that we have, and we're going to make up in a quarter or two.
Well, Don Reisinger, the problem with that argument is that the company that's making the most money by far in terms of profits is Apple, and they do the opposite of that. They say, here is our one and only phone, or nowadays, here are our two phones, the good one and the loser. And then they also, you know, there's almost no question that if Apple comes out with an iWatch, which everybody expects them to do, which a lot of people expect them to do, they're going to have one watch. They're going to say, here is the watch. They're not going to say, here are five watches, here are four watches, here's a watch, here's a band, whatever. And they've succeeded enormously with this. And the psychological factor behind this is a combination of buyer's remorse. So if you get one of these Samsung phones, they have a million phones, if you get one of them, or if you get one of their smart devices, after you buy it, you think, gosh, should I have gotten the other one? And you also have this paralysis of choice. When you go and see all, you say, oh, I'm going to get a Samsung phone. You look at all the phones they have. You're kind of like, I really don't know which one to get. I mean, the average user. And so that could be a problem. And that could be one of the reasons why a lot of the companies who are not Samsung, who also follow the strategy, tend to fail in the market. Buyer's remorse and paralysis of choice. Don't you think this is risky for them to be doing this?
You know, Mike, I kind of disagree with you with Apple. I have to say, I mean, okay, we have, you know, Apple has, what, four devices on store shelves right now, iPhones. You have the iPad, the iPad Mini, the iPad Air. You have all that. But those are those products. But then you also have Apple dabbling into Maps, taking on Google Maps. You have Apple trying to go after Pandora, the iTunes Radio. You're going to have an iWatch this year. There's possibility of Apple really expanding its Apple TV presence, whether it's through a set-top box and services or whether it's through the, you know, the vaporware that is the Apple television. I think we saw a lot more restraint when Steve Jobs was in charge. And I think we're seeing something that happened after Steve Jobs was let go at Apple and before he came back. And then now we're seeing it post Steve Jobs, where these executives are saying, you know what? Yeah, let's do this. Let's get into here. Let's do that. I see Apple kind of doing that. They're not spending as much money as, say, you know, a Facebook or a Google. But they're doing a lot of things that seem to fall outside of its core competency. I mean, you know, Apple Maps is a mess. iTunes Radio is okay, but, you know, there's a lot of question marks about that. You know, what is Apple going to do? There's talk about Apple maybe going after some Street View functionality. There's a lot of stuff going on there. And I think we might see more iPads this year. I think we might see more iPhones this year. We have talk about a phablet now from Apple. I think Apple's becoming that. I really do. I see it on a software level, and I do see it potentially this year on a hardware level.
Yeah, so Apple's definitely not perfect, but they do make about 2/3 of the industry's profits by themselves, one company out of hundreds. So they're not doing too badly. Now, a quick question for you, Vlad Savov, before we let you go. Samsung says that in order for Tizen to be considered successful by Samsung, they need 15% of Samsung's shipments to be running Tizen. Do you think they'll ever reach that number?
Well, you can never say never, obviously. Everything is possible, but that seems like a highly unrealistic thing to consider. When you have Android, you have Google Play services. Those are some of the biggest strengths of its Galaxy devices. And Samsung will have to go a long way to recreate those. So if Samsung wants 50% of its massive, enormous shipments of smartphones to be Tizen, it's going to be years before we reach that point.
All right. Well, thank you, Vlad Savov, for coming on Tech News today and explaining this Samsung strategy to us.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Vlad.
All right, you can find Vlad Savov on TheVerge.com, of course, and on Twitter. And I'm going to spell his Twitter handle, VladSavov. Well, in a sec, we're going to talk about the upcoming kill switch idea. But first, I want to tell you about ShareFile. If you're sending files around as attachments on email, you are not paying attention to the news and all the security nightmares that are flying around in every direction. The smart way to send files is by using ShareFile. Just go to ShareFile.com and check this out. It's easy to do, and you really need to be using ShareFile. You can send attachments, not as attachments, but as secure links. And you can transfer files of almost any size, gigabytes in size, very, very securely. And you can control who has access to these files and for how long they have access. And you can be alerted when somebody opens a file and when your files are received and viewed and so on. So it gives you enormous amounts of peace of mind. And that's very, very rare and important in today's security crazy world. So make sure you go to ShareFile.com and check this out today. I strongly recommend it. I personally started using this a few months ago. Then my wife discovered it when I shared some files with her. Then she shared some files with our accountant when we were working on our taxes. And now he shares it with all of his customers because it's so easy to use, so pleasant to use, and so secure. So this is the only way to be sending files around. If you're using emails to send files, use ShareFile.com. Sign up today for our 30-day free trial. No obligation at all. Go to ShareFile.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and enter TNT. And remember, visit ShareFile.com and type in TNT. Well, the mobile tech industry is volunteering to support the smartphone kill switch idea. Apple, Samsung, Google, HTC, Huawei, Nokia, and Microsoft have all agreed to build kill switches into future mobile devices. With us to explain this story is Phil Goldstein, editor of Fierce Wireless. Welcome, Phil.
Thanks for having me.
I'm glad you're here. Before we get into the specifics of this issue, can you briefly tell us what a kill switch is exactly?
So the idea of a kill switch, which has been put forward by lawmakers in a couple of different states, is that you would put this function into a smartphone or a tablet that would basically render the device useless if it was stolen. So it's, you know, this sort of foolproof anti-theft measure that has been bandied about. And I think that the measures that were announced by the wireless carriers and the device makers are, you know, steps in that direction, but I don't think that it rises to the level of the kill switch that I think a lot of people have been pushing for the past 6 to 12 months.
And especially some grandstanding politicians are jumping on this issue, and they are saying that the voluntary announcement, you know, the announcement of voluntary embrace of kill switches that we're hearing about today is not enough. So what is it that's missing from this voluntary initiative?
I think that, you know, you're hearing this from folks like Eric Schneiderman, who's the Attorney General of New York State, and George Gascon, who's the District Attorney of San Francisco, I believe, and some other politicians in California. You're hearing that, you know, this is kind of an opt-in policy, that this has been embraced by the five largest U.S. wireless carriers of Verizon, AT&T, Sprint, T-Mobile, U.S. Cellular, along with, as you mentioned, Apple, Google, HTC, Huawei, Motorola, Microsoft, Nokia, and Samsung. So a lot of big companies. They're basically saying, you know, this is kind of a opt-in solution, that it just doesn't go, you know, as far as they would like in terms of, you know, having that definitive kill switch technology. There are a lot of tools that they're embracing. So they're saying that, and this applies, by the way, to devices that are going to be manufactured, I believe, after July 2015 for retail sale in the U.S. So they're going to have things like remote wiping of your data if the device is lost or stolen, a tool that is going to make the smartphone inoperable unless you put in a PIN, you know, a tool that is going to prevent reactivation of the phone without authorization, and a tool that's going to allow users to restore their data if they recover it. So, you know, that's a wide range of tools. You know, I think that a lot of politicians have sort of been basing their arguments on having this kill switch technology, and, you know, I think that they're not really going to be fully satisfied unless they get that.
Now, one of the things that critics of kill switches will say is that there's a risk of hackers getting control of these features and killing a phone that somebody that the owner is using. That's one argument. I'm not sure if that's a credible argument, and you can address that. But and the other issue is just the fact that the politicians want to make this mandatory. Shouldn't the market decide? Shouldn't consumers decide whether they want devices to have kill switches?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the argument about hackers using the kill switches, I think it's plausible, probably not likely. And in terms of having the market decide, I think that you're seeing obviously a lot of big companies saying, okay, we think that taking these measures is a good idea. As far as mandating it goes, I'm not sure that there's a huge consumer demand for it. Although, if you look at the statistics of cell phone thefts, it is going up, especially in, major metropolitan areas like New York City, San Francisco, Washington, D.C. How prevalent of a problem this is nationwide, I think that is a little bit more difficult to glean at this point. It's obviously a problem for anybody who worries about having their device stolen. But up until now, you're not seeing a huge sort of grassroots consumer demand that kill switches be mandated for all devices. I think for some people, it would obviously be a nice thing to have if their device is stolen. But I think that these measures, as the politicians and law enforcement officials acknowledge, are a step in the right direction.
Yeah, to your point and to Mike's point, are we putting a Band-Aid on a much, much, much bigger issue? And that is, do consumers really care about mobile security? I think, those of us here in the tech world and those that follow the tech world do, and we think about that a lot. But does the average person, running an Android device, really think about that ad that just came through that might be, any kind of scam and could be anything else? Do they, I don't necessarily think that the average individual who doesn't have time to read the, the Verges, the CNets, and go to the Twits of the world, either A, knows too much about mobile security or cares too much about mobile security until they're directly affected. And, maybe that's where the government can come in and sort of say, look, you know, everyone needs to start thinking about this. I mean, when you look at the mobile space, 98% of all hacks are happening on Android. And study after study, we're seeing that the actual many of the issues are because of users and they're not doing the right things with their products. I think it's a public knowledge thing. It's a public ignorance thing more than anything else. I think these people are buying their devices saying, yeah, Windows is that thing that causes all the security problems. This Android device or this iPhone or whatever it might be, that's not an issue. The physical theft is one thing. The data theft is another. And I think that we really need to do a better job, maybe as a tech community, maybe as just, in general, educating people on why mobile security is so important and why the hackers around the world, the bad guys, I don't like to say hackers, the malicious hackers around the world, because there's a lot of good ones out there too. The malicious hackers around the world are increasingly targeting mobile devices because they see that there's a general ignorance out there and they say, we can capitalize, we can make the money we want, we can make cash, we can do what we want to do. And I think that might be the broader issue here.
Yeah, and I think one thing that has to be said, though, about consumer demand for this, for kill switches, essentially, is that, the most consumer-y product out there, arguably, is the Apple iPhone, and they have activation lock on iOS 7, which, for the most part, is kill switchy type of set of features. And they're an influential one of the market leaders out there driving what companies do. But I do understand Phil Goldstein, the argument of the politicians, which is that the way to make kill switches are a real deterrent to theft is for crooks to know that every single phone is protected with a kill switch. And once they know that, then and only then can they go down? If it's still a roll of the dice and maybe it's got a kill switch and maybe it doesn't, then they'll continue to nab these phones and you know, actually put lives at risk. There's a safety issue with people, you know, stealing phones. But that's essentially the argument, isn't it? They're trying to get a universality of activation lock type features.
Right. I think that, you know, they're trying to, as you say, you know, make this, basically foolproof, and make this a solution that everybody can rely on. You're obviously going to get a big part of the U.S. market buying into this in terms of the carriers and the handset makers who have embraced these voluntary principles. But a lot of phones that are stolen in the U.S. wind up overseas. So, it's a question of whether or not this solution can be implemented on an international basis. And, you know, just going back to the discussion about consumer education, about security in general on mobile, I think that if you look back 15, 20 years ago, you know, there was obviously a lot of education that happened in terms of desktop security as the internet was becoming more prevalent. I think that we're starting to go through a wave where consumers, you know, as smartphone penetration increases, consumers are going to become more aware of mobile security threats. But I think that there's obviously a lot more that, wireless carriers, device makers, and the general technology community and, policymakers can do to educate consumers about mobile security, not just, physical security like we've been talking about, but about mobile security in general.
All right. Well, Phil Goldstein, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News today. This is a complex issue, and one way or the other, we're going to get this this kill switch feature on phones, whether it's voluntarily, involuntary, whatever, it's coming. And so we thank you for explaining it all.
Thank you for having me.
All right. You can find Phil Goldstein on FierceWireless.com and also on Twitter at Fierce Wireless. Well, a French company called LaCie, which is a subsidiary of Seagate that sells hard drives, says nearly everyone who shopped on their website over the past year is at risk from personal data theft. Graham Cluley is an independent security analyst, and he joins us today. Welcome, Graham.
Hi there.
So how did this vulnerability exist for a year before anyone discovered it?
Boy, oh boy, and they didn't even discover it themselves. It turns out the FBI were actually the people to let them know about it. And I think that's the way of modern cybercrime, is that the criminals don't announce the fact that they've hacked you. You know, they're not going to put up a message on your screen. They're just going to slowly exfiltrate as much of your data as they can and run off with it.
Now, what sort of data were they able to potentially grab?
So they grabbed usernames, email addresses, payment card information as well. LaCie also are suggesting that people should change their passwords. Of course, if you're using the same password on other websites as well, then it's good practice to make sure you never use the same passwords in multiple places. So there's quite a lot of personal information there. And obviously the risk is that the payment card information could be abused as well.
Now, I understand that this is part of a wider hack that affected dozens of online stores, and it's related to Adobe's Cold Fusion software. Is that your understanding as well? And if so, what are those other stores?
Yeah, so it looks like there's been actually a wave of different attacks against different sites which are using Cold Fusion, Adobe's software. And one of the other places is the Renault website, for instance. Information was taken from there. And Brian Krebs, the well-known cyber sleuth, has been documenting this. He actually wrote about LaCie's breach a month ago and contacted them saying, is this true? And it's only now that they've actually come forward and said, yes, turns out we have got a serious problem and we have had it for over a year, well, round about a year, actually. But that, of course, says to us that these vulnerabilities have existed for a year, which means that these companies haven't been properly updating their server software, their Cold Fusion software. This gang have been exploiting vulnerabilities in the software to break in and take advantage of them. There is some suggestion that these hacks could be in some way connected with, of course, the breach against Adobe itself, when Adobe lost the source code for Cold Fusion. And there was always the sort of conspiracy theory, was that perhaps done in order to find vulnerabilities? Well, let's hope that the authorities catch whoever's responsible for this, and maybe we'll get an answer to those questions.
Is it time to finally just go to Adobe and say, you know what, guys? You're causing a lot of trouble around the web. I mean, you know, whether it's Flash, whether it's this, Adobe has been one of the biggest. I mean, Microsoft said, look, one of the biggest issues with Windows security has been Adobe products. Steve Jobs wrote an open letter about it. You know, at what point do we all kind of look at Adobe and say, you know, I think we criticize Adobe when things happen. We could tie it back to Adobe. But at what point do we really take Adobe to task and say, you guys need to work much, much, much better at your security initiatives? You know, it's nonsense. It's absolute nonsense. And Adobe's not the only one. Don't get me wrong. Obviously, we have a lot of issues out there in terms of security. But Adobe continues to be just a real issue, I think. And it's high time we start focusing a little bit more on what Adobe's doing and see how that impacts the rest of us. Because I do think there's something going on here.
I do feel sometimes that they are the Swiss cheese of security holes. You know, they are riddled. And sometimes you kind of want to write them a Dear John letter. You know how you normally say, look, it's not you, it's me. And that's why we have to break up. Right. Well, in Adobe's case, it really is you. There's a problem with you guys. You've got to fix this. To give them some credit, in the last couple of years, they have actually got better. I know they maybe started from a very low starting point, but they are more regularly issuing security updates. They're beginning to get their software to automatically update itself against security vulnerabilities, and that's all good news. I've seen more focus on security from Adobe, but you can only be hit so many times, can't you? If I was actually to put them in order, the one actually I would put right at the top right now would be Oracle with Java, and there's something right. Most people just simply do not need it on their computers. And that's something which the hackers are constantly abusing.
Now, Retro D in the chat room is making a very good point, which is that this comparison is unfair to Swiss cheese. And so we'd like to officially apologize to Swiss cheese and the Swiss people for that nasty comparison. So, Graham Cluley, very quickly, what advice do you have for people who want to protect themselves, who buy things online and want to protect themselves from this kind of thing?
Oh, boy. I mean, obviously, if you're going to make payments online, maybe use a credit card, then at least maybe you'll have some insurance if it does get used for fraud that you can get the money back. Use different passwords to different sites, but really give the online companies a hard time. Quiz them. Are you doing security updates? Are you securing our passwords? Are they hashed and sorted in your databases? Interesting, Lassie, haven't talked about encryption at all here. So there's a big question mark now as to whether those passwords, how they were being stored.
That is interesting. And Graham Cluley, I want to thank you for joining us today and telling us about this this crazy hack. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. You can find Graham Cluley at grahamcluley.com and also on Twitter at gcluley. Well, we've reported in past episodes that Google's developing an experimental Android phone called Project Tango. The phone can map indoor environments in real time using some special cameras, processors, and other exotic hardware. Miroslav Djurek is with iFixit. He's the chief information architect for iFixit, and he got his hands on one and took it apart. Welcome, Miroslav.
Hi, Mike. How's it going?
It's going great. Now, how in the world did you get Google to hand one of these over to you guys? If I had one, I don't think I'd give it to you.
They just contacted us and told us, hey, here's one for you guys to take apart because we don't want the developers to take theirs apart.
Wow, that's amazing. So they contacted you. That's incredible. Now, I understand they didn't want you to power it up. Why is that?
Well, they sent us a non-functional unit because there are, you know, lots of NDA restrictions and things like that. And so they didn't want us to reverse engineer the hardware. They just wanted us to show people what's inside, talk about the technologies, but not necessarily figure out how all the nitty-gritties work out because that's all proprietary.
Now, obviously, this phone has some components that are pretty workaday standard Android phone components, but there are also some very extreme hardware things that you don't normally find inside a smartphone. Can you tell us about some of those?
Yeah, so it's powered by a Snapdragon 800 processor, and it has 2 gigs of RAM and 64 gigs of flash. So that's kind of the normal off-the-shelf stuff that you see in pretty much all the current smartphones. We do have some other fun things. There are actually 2 cameras in the back, in addition to an infrared sensor, and then there's a front-facing camera as well. So with the 2 in the back, there's actually one that's a fisheye lens that can view 180 degrees, and actually have it right here. It's a teeny tiny little component.
Wow, that is small.
Yeah. So, and you know, the standard cell phone sizes these days. And then what it does is it uses the two cameras, which are on opposite ends of the phone, as well as the infrared sensor, to blast, essentially project a field of infrared light, and then figure out with that grid how far away each specific object is in front of it.
Now, I'm not an expert at this by any stretch of the imagination, but my understanding is that the real secret sauce of this phone is the speed at which it processes the visual information coming back from the camera. Is that correct? And what is the hardware inside that enables that performance?
So it has, I think we found two visual processors inside the phone. There's one here that was actually, it was kind of strange because it was acquired by Apple just a while back. So aside from the OmniVision cameras, let me take a quick look here. It was Prime Sense's new Capri PS1200 processor. And so we were very surprised to see that in there because Apple had purchased Prime Sense just a while back. So we're not sure, you know, how long ago Project Tango was initiated, but it was rather interesting to see that in there. In addition to it, we also found a couple of Movidius Myriad 1 computer vision processors. So they're kind of like a GPU that you would have under normal circumstances, except that these guys are actually processing video coming in and then figuring out, kind of like your human eye, where things are located in three dimensions.
Miroslav, you know, based on what you've seen, taking this thing apart and everything, how do you see this being used? You know, based on the components, based on what you've seen, how do you think this is going to be used?
You know, that's a very interesting question. And honestly, I don't know. It's going to have lots of interesting possibilities with it, just kind of like Google Glass does. So, I mean, one possibility would be to take this phone around and you can essentially do your own version of Google Street View, but inside your house. You know, you would be able to figure out how things look like and document everything in three dimensions. And I'm not sure, you know, what kind of gaming implications there might be or other sorts of things that they could use this in the future.
I've seen
that. My first thought was gaming. I mean, that was something that I thought it seemed like a natural extension of that. But beyond that, to me at least, and of course, I don't know Google's plan. I'm just, you know, spitballing here. You know, I think this is more fun than substance. It almost sounds like it's like, okay, that's kind of cool. It's a cool thing to do. It's interesting. But, you know, until you can create real apps that we care about behind it, why do I need it? And I'm seeing a lot of that from Google, I think, lately. And it goes back kind of to the conversation we were having earlier. Google's a big company with lots of money. Mm-hmm. Let's try this out. Let's see what we can do with it. If it turns out cool, we'll find ways to make it work. And maybe this is one of those technologies.
It could very well be. They're basically packing the hardware of a Microsoft Kinect into a smartphone. Right. I mean, that's kind of the gist of it. And so, you know, the Kinect itself has already somewhat revolutionized, you know, how you can play video games, right? You're no longer holding a controller. Now you are the controller. So those kinds of implications are now available in a smartphone. And so we'll see down the line what kind of apps can be developed. But it's a very, very interesting technology. And, you know, that's why it has a very beefy battery in the back so that all of this stuff is powered and actually able to be processed.
Well, Miroslav Djurek, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News today and sharing your discoveries with us.
Thank you, sir.
Your teardowns are the industry standard, and I really enjoy them a great deal.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, great stuff. Great stuff, Miroslav.
All right, you can find Miroslav Djurek on iFixit.com, of course, and on Twitter at MDJURIC. Well, Google rolled out today a previously announced ad format called Plus Post Ads. The format takes a regular Google Plus post on a page account rather than a personal account and turns it into an interactive ad display. And Don Reisinger, this is a fascinating difference that Google has over everybody else. This is one of the most original things that Google offers. And then let me just see if I can explain it concisely. Essentially, the way Facebook monetizes its social network is that it sells ads and then puts those ads on Facebook and also on its many ads that it keeps, its many apps that it keeps generating. What Google's doing here is that a page, you know, call it the, you know, the Pepsi page or whatever, can just create a regular Google Plus post and then activate it as a Plus post ad. And that goes into the circulation of its advertising, display advertising online. So a user might come on a totally unrelated page, see a picture, click on it, and when they click on it, the picture expands to the center of the page, hovers over it, and in fact, it's not just a picture, it's that Google Plus post totally separated from the Google Plus site. And then users can share it, they can plus one it, they can add comments to it. And all of this, again, is happening outside of Google Plus. So it's kind of a reverse ad. It's the opposite of what Facebook is doing. Is this brilliant, or will this fail? What do you think, Don?
I think it'd be great if it was on Facebook. I mean, something that people actually use all that often. I mean, it's a great idea in terms of serving ads. Is it going to become a very annoying idea for people that actually use this stuff? Possibly, but I think there's a good chance of it. You know, I think ultimately the marketers are going to be the ones to decide what this turns out to be. I mean, you know, there are a lot of question marks about Google Plus and its stickiness and whether there's enough engagement on the service. I think this is going to be an opportunity for marketers to figure that out and see how it bridges the gap with their other digital marketing efforts. I don't know. There's a sense with me that Google Plus is just still an ancillary service that most people don't care about. And I think that might ultimately be the issue here more than just the fact that this is a new way to present ads.
Well, my view on that is that Google Plus appears to be Google's version of Facebook. And it was somebody else, I don't recall who said it, but it's really Google's version of Google. It's the future version of Google. And when they started this whole initiative, it wasn't about having a Facebook-like social network. It was about creating a social layer for the web. And Plus Post Ads is exactly what that is. If you're an advertiser, you want to put display ads on the internet, you're going to put those things out there anyway. Why not make it an interactive social media style post that people can interact with and share and do all those kinds of things, even for people who don't have Google Plus accounts, even for people who don't even know what Google Plus is, they don't know how to spell Google Plus, they can still interact with these ads and create a social thing. And Facebook's approach to advertising is to get people to go to their pages on Facebook. And the problem there is people don't go to Facebook to engage with ads. They go to Facebook to post food pictures and share cat photos and stuff like that. And so it's really not the place where people want to go do, you know, be the recipient of marketing, whereas the open internet with display ads is. And again, this is one of the things that creates stickiness. And by the way, one of the universal success stories of Google Plus is Hangouts. People tend to like Hangouts. There are a lot of prominent Hangouts out there. And one of the things you can do with Plus Post ads is you can promote Hangouts. So you can say, you know, if you've got a Hangout coming out, you can scatter your promotion all over the internet. And by clicking on that display ad, people can then sign up for the Hangout and sort of, you know, be notified when it's going to happen and do all the things you can do with Hangouts. So it's a pretty interesting.
I think it's interesting. But again, now, see, going back to the Facebook mention, I mean, Facebook is trying to expand its reach across the web. I mean, let's not forget last year, Mark Zuckerberg went out and said, look, we're going to make it so much easier for you to interact with Facebook and put Facebook on your sites. And Facebook is going to be everywhere on the internet. So maybe this is partly a response to that. It's, you know, it's saying, look, okay, you can interact with Google Plus too on different sites. I think that ultimately we're going to see a battle. We're seeing a battle develop now between the companies, but I think it's going to really, really hit a breaking point in the next couple of years as Facebook tries to implement essentially bringing the Facebook brand, integrating Facebook into the web, I think is the best way to put it. And I think that's where Zuckerberg wants to go. I think that's something that Google worries about. And maybe this is step one in Google's response.
Yeah, it's a good point you're making. Well, in a sec, we're going to give you one more quick security story. But first, I want to tell you about Gazelle. Gazelle is an awesome service that will buy your used gadget. Why would you want to sell your used gadget to Gazelle? Because then you can buy your next gadget. That's what I do. It's really, really an easy service to use. You simply go to gazelle.com. That's G-A-Z-E-L-L-E.com. You find the device that you'd like to sell. Tell them what the condition is, and then they'll give you a price. Jason is putting one on there. What is that? That's an iPhone.
5S, 64 gig on Sprint.
For $250, they'll give for it. That is a really, really good price for that phone. I wouldn't expect that, and you probably couldn't sell it anywhere near that on the so-called open market. You get paid in cash, and payment is fast. You can get paid with check, PayPal, or the best option, in my opinion, is the Amazon gift card option, because you get 5% more money from Gazelle on that. Gazelle has paid more than $100 million to more than 700,000 customers. Shipping is free, fast, and easy. So find out what your Apple or Android device is worth. Take a minute. Go to gazelle.com to find out. And do it now, because your device may lose value the longer you wait. Well, the internet security software company Kaspersky recently unveiled a slick and polished interactive global map showing all the known cyber threats in real time. This is a pretty, pretty website. Look at how beautiful that is. It's also terrifying. Look at all the activity going on. Don Reisinger, this is a pretty astonishing sight, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's probably only a fraction of the real security issues out there. I mean, you know, these companies can't see everything. They don't see everything. But, yeah, it's a scary world. And you look at that and you wonder, how can you truly be secure no matter what you're doing, no matter how secure your passwords are, no matter, you know, how long you stay off the web? There are some people that they don't even, you know, I turn my computer on, I do my financial stuff, and I turn it back off and I'm safe. You know, look, you're not safe. There's nothing to be said. There's something to be said for that, and saying, look, we're all in trouble here. And I think we all need to get our act together and figure out how we're going to try to turn the tide. I mean, these hackers, the malicious hackers, again, these guys are out there. They're way ahead of the security firms. Security firms are trying to catch up. We're finding things like we saw with Lassie about a year later. You know, Heartbleed. I mean, two years. What the hell is going on? We need to get some smarter people out there and start fixing these problems.
Absolutely. And there are two things everybody needs to know about security. Number one is that if you haven't been hacked yet, that doesn't mean that you haven't been hacked yet. Right. You always find out about security nightmares when it's too late, when you've been, you know, in the case of Lassie, for example, we heard about earlier, you know, this has been going on for a year before the FBI found out and then informed the company. So that's the one thing that you need to know. The second thing you need to know is there's a lot you can do. Yes, the threats are out there and everybody's going to try to hack your stuff. But there are certain basic things you can do. You use LastPass or some other password service. You can use two-step authentication for the sites that use that. You can use ShareFile to send files around. There are basic fundamental things that every user should do, because your stuff is not secure. And again, like you said, there's an arms race between the malicious hackers out there and the security industry. And it seems like lately the malicious hackers are kind of pulling ahead. And so you really need to take, you can't just sit back and let companies automatically give you the default security that you get when you buy products. You have to take certain basic actions. And I also recommend that people listen to Security Now. This isn't just a regular pitch. This is a fantastic show that will keep you up to date with what's happening. And security affects everyone, and it's of concern to everyone. So,
hey,
you
can
know,
I make one more point, Mike?
Please do.
Real quick about security. And I wrote about this on one of those webs, eWeek, a few weeks ago. We got this from a security firm just before the Windows XP support ended on last week. The number was 98% of ATM machines around the world are still running Windows XP. Now, I don't know if that number is lower because of the end of support, but I mean, that just goes to show you, it's not just when you go on the internet, it's when you're going to the bank down the road. And potentially that ATM, which is running on Windows XP, which is no longer being patched, no longer being supported, could be a huge security risk for you. So, I mean, that I think illustrates just the depth at which the security problems around the world are occurring, and it's sort of scary.
Yeah, you got to protect yourself. And before we go, this is a live breaking news story that was brought to my attention by the chat room. And the story is that Google has released a new app in the Play Store called the Android Camera app. And you should check it out if you're an Android user and like to take pictures, it, which is, you know, lots of people.
Completely changes the UI, by the way.
Really?
Yeah,
you've already got it.
Oh, yeah, I've already got it. I mean, it's completely different. Check it out. It's interesting. It has its own version of the foreground solid background blur, which everybody's doing now. So, yeah, very interesting stuff.
Yeah. And apologies to HTC for having Google going out there and undermining their big feature.
Everybody's on that bandwagon right now.
I guess you don't need two lenses after all. Well, Don Risinger, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News Today this morning.
Hey, thank you. I had a great time. I appreciate it.
I had a great time, too. Thank you so much. Actually, Don, before we go, tell people where people can find your work, because you're all over the place, aren't you?
Yeah, kind of. You know, I write for CNET, eWeek, CO Insights, Slash Gear, a bunch of different places. So, you know, just search me on Google. Go to my Twitter account. I sometimes put stuff up there. I'm not as active there as I probably should be. But, yeah, I'm all over the place. You'll probably find it at some point, hopefully. And hopefully you'll like it.
All right. Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly do, and I thank you for coming on.
Hey, thank you.
All right, we don't want you to subscribe to Tech News Today. You can subscribe to the audio version, the video version, whichever version you like, but subscribe at twit.tv/TNT. We also want to hear from you. Send us an email at tnt@twit.tv or leave us a voicemail by calling 260-TNT-SHOW. Also, don't miss our evening newscast, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific tonight and every weeknight. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow.